Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear A Glimpse of Cleveland, a crystal ball for the Republican National Convention. The speaker will be Hal Dobb, former congressman from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, former mayor of the city of Omaha, and currently a member of the University of Nebraska Board of Regents. Mr. Dobb has attended 10 Republican National Conventions. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 16, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kay Criss, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today's forum, A Glimpse of Cleveland, a crystal ball for the Republican National Convention. Now, we started planning this forum probably in April, before we had any presumptive nominees. Hal Dobb will be leading this forum. He's attended 10 national Republican conventions. Dobb will discuss the current status, the party insiders' activities, the city scene with protesters, etc., and then the options and consequences going forward to the fall general election. Mr. Dobb is an attorney and Republican Party politician in Nebraska who served four terms in the United States House of Representatives and as mayor of Omaha. In 2012, Hal Dobb was elected to the Board of Regents of the University of Nebraska system. He will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll take your questions. There's paper and pencil on your table. We need you to write down your questions, and they will be brought to me, and I will read them from the podium. Join me in welcoming Hal Dobb.
This is a great turnout today. Thank you all for coming. It's always good to get together, and when you can break bread together, normally you can leave afterwards as friends and not be too wound up about the subject. I want to thank you all for coming because I know you're anxious to learn as much as you can about the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. wrong speech. I think maybe I will try to do some contrasting. I see we have elected officials here. Councilman Paul, thank you very much for coming. It's nice to see you. I think we have a candidate, Mary Jane Trumper. Nice to see you, Mary Jane. Are there other anyone else I'm missing that currently holds public office? I always like to acknowledge those people that are willing to stand in the breach and service in public life. It's kind of good to kind of see Citizen Ruth and elections up there with Alexander Payne, and he has an interest in politics, and a lot of the film work he's done has been an interesting way to do it. I don't know why my picture is here. I think that they moved them around. I guess they knew that I was coming. I'm going to ask a little bit of trivia. Let's start off with a little bit of trivia, and the listening audience could play this as well and think about this. Name the year in which the Republican Party had a contested national quadrennial convention. 1861. Way, way back, yes. But what in recent memory was the last contested convention? What year? 1976. President Ford, contested by then Governor Ronald Reagan, if you'll recall. It was the last open convention. Since then, they've all been basically closed by the function of the way in which the structure of the Republican Party thereafter was designed. So in the Republican Party, it generally commits itself to one woman and one man, National Committee woman, a National Committee man, and a state chair, and those would be equivalent to what you listen to the Democrats talk about when they talk about superdelegates. Those three times 50 states plus the five territories would be the total number of automatic delegates to the Republican National Convention. All other delegates are elected by their state party conventions. And in a few cases, there are some appointments, but they generally end up being contested. And as a member of the Credentials Committee, on which I will sit, the week before our convention convenes, there'll be states like Colorado and New Mexico that have contests about whether you were properly elected or appointed to be a voting delegate to the convention. And the Virgin Islands will have a contest. There were two slates and two different conventions held there. And they'll be vying in front of our committee to see which one of them gets the right to sit and vote. It's the one place where, in our party, my party, the territories, the Guam, Virgin Islands, Marshall Islands, Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico, get a fairly significant number of votes that it can influence the outcomes, not only in terms of who the nominee becomes, but then on platform issues. Another major reason why both parties meet, as you know, is because they debate policy. And on your tables, I drop the book off. You might just pass it around, and it's the recorded activity of each convention that I've attended. There's a big, huge book put together, and all of the details are made public in they used to, like back in 1980 in this one, bind them. And then they got thinking that was pretty expensive, so they've got them done with a paperback cover. And the one President Ford's Day wasn't done that way. It was done, it was entitled Presidential Election. There were two of those books I laid on table. So you kind of pass them around, take a look at them, just get some idea that, that there is a record of what goes on at the Republican convention. Trivia. Who won that 1976 election? Jimmy Carter and his running mate? Walter Mondale. That's right. And then the 49th Quadrennial Convention was held in 1980. So my buddies and I, we drove from Omaha down to Kansas City. It was close, and we wanted to see what was going on. We were just young, so I was not a voting delegate. But I've been a delegate to each convention since, so starting in 1980, and including this convention. And when you go as a delegate from Nebraska to a convention, you go bound by the vote of the people in the primary, on the primary ballot. So you, in the old days in Nebraska, used to be able to run on the public ballot to be a delegate. And you could indicate you were committed to the candidate of your choice. And you would win or lose, normally, based upon that person you publicly said to whom you would commit your votes. We've changed all that now, and you run as a delegate. You don't have to run committed. You can run uncommitted, if you will. But it makes no difference. The delegation, even if you would run and win a voting seat committed to a different candidate than the popular vote in the primary, our delegation, by rule, is bound to the first on the first two ballots at the convention to the nominee that the public chooses. And I kind of like that, personally, because I think that's another way that representative government should be working, that the people have something to say about the nominee of the, of their party, and that's translated. We can't all go. That's what representative government's all about, so we select people to go with us. That's why in the early days they were called select men and women, rather in the old days, but up in the New England states particularly. It's one person selected to go forward. We all can't go, and that person should speak for us. So that's kind of how we do it. We don't have quota system in the Republican Party. We don't break our delegation or the composition of the National Convention, which is 2,470 delegates and 2,302 alternates. So that'll be the total number of passes that are awarded to people to give them credentials to be participants in the convention. There'll be 15,000 and growing credentialed press. So already 15,000 bona fide, legitimate people that report news to their trade associations, to their news wire services, to foreign news outlets will be credentialed to come to the convention. This will be the fourth time the convention's been held in Ohio. The cities have been Kansas City in 76, then Detroit, Dallas, New Orleans, Houston, San Diego, Philadelphia, New York City, St. Paul, Minnesota, Tampa, Florida, and now Cleveland, Ohio. Give you some idea of the variety and kind of the size of the community, the city, the capability that city has to have enough hotel rooms, because there'll be 50, 60, 70,000 people that'll be there for anywhere from 12 days down to the 4 days of the convention, because a lot of work goes on before the convention starts. Your credentials committee that determines who's legal, who can vote. And then there is a rules committee that determines what the rules will be. And you hear discussion right now, do you not, about will that rules committee, which is dominated by people that were favorable to Cruz, will try to change the rules. But at the end of the day, Speaker Ryan, who's been designated as the general presiding officer of the convention, will perhaps be bound to put to a vote of the convention when the credentials committee reports. The second vote might be that somehow the rules change. For example, all delegates shall be unbound. That is a rule that could be proposed. And if it was reported out, all the delegates on the floor, 2,470 of them, would vote on whether that rule should be changed or not. There are about 400,000 people in the city of Cleveland, but the greater metropolitan area, of course, has several million people. There are 19 Fortune 500 companies headquartered in Cleveland, so it's a very, very interesting city, and it's a city of business and commerce, and it has a pretty good employment and a pretty stable employment. Well, more trivia. Does anybody remember in 1980 who won? Ronald Reagan. And who was President Reagan's running mate? Dan Quayle. George Bush. And then, of course, that they ran again for a second term, right, in 1984 and won. And it was Jimmy Carter and Mondale seeking a second term that Reagan and Bush bested. And then when you go to 84, interesting enough, Mondale, and who was Mondale's running mate? Geraldine Ferraro, right? And they lost to a second term Reagan Bush. Then George H.W. Bush ran, and his running mate, somebody said it a minute ago, Dan Quayle, right? And they ran against who? Somebody, did I give you a hint? Well, Dukakis. Michael Dukakis. Remember on the top of the turret of the tank? Yeah. Turn left, right? And who was his running mate? Lloyd Benson. Bud Seinhorst, the executive director of the Republican Party, knew the answer to that one. Okay, getting tuned up for convention, huh? I better know your facts. Okay. And then they ran for a second term, and this time they ran against, in 1992, Clinton and Gore, right? You remember the famous debate in Omaha, though, right? When Dan Quayle was instructed by Lloyd Benson that he personally knew Jack Kennedy. He was a personal friend of mine, and you're no Jack Kennedy. Remember that? I was sitting in the front row at the old city auditorium. I remember that. I knew that one was going to be a tale to be told. Clinton, Gore win that election and then stand up against, in 1996, which is when Mary and I first went to convention together in San Diego, Bob Dole, and who was his running mate?
Jack Kemp,
that's correct. Jack Kemp. And then, well, that was the first time that somebody had won the popular election without winning the popular vote. In terms of percentages, 49% to 47.9. And there was a interesting new independent candidate that stuck up his head in that election. Do you know who it was? Ross Perot, right? And Ross Perot was in, and anybody remember who his running mate was? Stockdale, right? Right? Why am I here, right? That's exactly right. Why am I here? What am I doing here? That was really a hoot. And then you go to Bob Dole, but Perot actually ran in the losing Bush election and then ran again the second year with a guy named, was it Choate? Yeah, right? Never even knew who he was, but he ended up being on that ticket. Now, in 2000, we're in Philadelphia. George Bush ran, and who was George Bush's running mate? George H.W. Bush. You know, the rabbit? Cheney. Dick Cheney, right? They all have a little anecdotal story that you can tell about them. There's some one thing seems to stick in my mind anyway for most of them. And who was their competition was Mr. Gore, right, coming off of the vice presidency, now running for the presidency in the next election. And who was his running mate?
Joe Lieberman,
right. And quite an accomplished person, and actually a good pick for Gore. George Bush won that election, if you remember, and then ran again in 2004 there in New York City. Mr. Nader is the third party candidate, if you remember. And, well, how did George Bush get to be president? He didn't win the popular vote. What happened? Went to court, right? The hanging Chad, right? The Florida, the saga of the hanging Chad and all of that. And so that it was determined in court. So that's why the electoral votes count, and I'll get to that in just a minute. And then Bush and Cheney against Kerry, and who was Kerry's running mate? He was a senator until he decided that he – Edwards, right? He kind of – That's a story in and to itself. And then here comes John McCain and his running mate was – And they ran against whom? Obama and Biden. And then Obama and Biden run for their next second four term. A guy named Johnson got into the third party race, if you remember, and then was the third party candidate again in 2016. Romney had a running mate named Paul Ryan, and of course, Obama and Biden won that election. Now, we know who the nominees are going to be for this one, don't we? We call them presumptive. But the system of the way delegates in the Republican Party are determined is a straight up and down vote in every state, mostly based on popular vote. And so you can project pretty well and pretty clearly without a lot of fuzziness, maybe. The Democrat composition is by a series of categories. So the total vote of the Democratic Party has not the one man, one vote rule, but so many from small states, so many from big states, so many women, so many minorities, so many ethnic groups. There's a whole set of categories that they award proportionally votes to, based on a formula that I've never seen. If you were looking at the electoral map, why is the Electoral College important? Because our framing founders said that, well, for example, today, if we went by one man, one vote, and the popular vote to determine who would be president, you would never see a candidate of either party in Nebraska. There'd be over half the registered vote in America resides in 11 cities in the 11 mega states. And that is where those elections would, by and large, be fought and determined. So the Electoral College, with great wisdom on the part of our framing founders, right, said, let's kind of have another check in this check and balance system, and that is the Electoral College will balance out the small states and the big states, like we have a House and a Senate. We have two from each in the Senate. We have proportional in the House, 435. That's another one of the checks and balances. So it's a very important for, I think, if you're an advocate of wanting Nebraska's voice to be heard, if you want a small state's voice to be heard, if I mean small by population by and large, not by geography, then you would understand and appreciate the value of the Electoral College and be opposed to fiddling with that because it's served us so well. What else would be interesting? So it's possible, and you've read the scenarios, that you could get down to almost a tie vote in this election. This election's electoral map looks like it could be within 10 to 12 electoral votes one way or the other. As you, if you speculate today where Pennsylvania goes, where Ohio goes, where New Mexico goes, where Colorado goes, where Florida goes, and maybe now North Carolina, you're getting into that range of about, I think, a very close race. So would Omaha's vote, would this second congressional district's vote, since we're one of two states, as you know, that are proportional, would it make a difference? I doubt that one vote makes a difference, because if one vote makes a difference, there's going to be a lot of other problems that would precede that. And so I think that the way the races will be fought, they'll be fought in those states that I just mentioned. And they, both the candidates here for the House will benefit from the speculation over that vote turnout that would create the potential for Mrs. Clinton to get the electoral vote here. And so Mr. Ashford will have a lot of money that he'll get automatically that maybe not he wouldn't have gotten normally because it's the electoral vote that they're chasing. So voter turnout makes a big difference. The same thing would be true for Brigadier General Bacon. The Republican Party will look at this as an opportunity to pick up an electoral vote. So that'll be interesting. So both of those races will end up having a lot more money that appears to be devoted to their spending than would normally be a part of the 2nd District House race this time around because of the perception that there's maybe a close electoral battle that's underway right now. The voter turnout was interesting, I thought, to share this observation. Over these quadrennial national conventions for the Republican Party, the total voter turnout of Americans voting in 1976, it was 81 million. And in 2012, 129 million. So now we always hear of the lack of interest, the lack of turnout. In fact, the participation rate in presidential years is always higher than the other 3 years in between in any election, state or federal. But it leveled out between 2008 and 2012. McCain and Romney and the Republican Party, the turnout was about 129 million. Up from 122 in the last Bush election, up from 101 million in the first George W. Bush election. It was in the election of Clinton Gore over Dole and Kemp, it dropped to 83 million from over up in the 90s to 100s before that. So it was a very sharp drop off. Remember the word malaise? And that was the characterization of a lot of the way voters felt. Well, think about what's going on right now. If you plug your ears, close your eyes, close your mouth, and go to sleep tonight, and don't wake up until the eve of this election, I predict you won't have missed much. And I say that because, with all due respect, I think both the nominees of the two parties are fairly well known by the large, I think, the predominantly the voting people that will vote in this election already know a little bit or a lot about both candidates. So it's not so much the emotion of what you may not like to hear explained to you over and over again and repeated for the next 4.5 months by each candidate. It's the idea that if you strip all that away, I think the voters will pretty much begin to understand that there's a national security issue, there's a defense, foreign relations issue, and there's an economy and jobs issue. And you peel back all the rhetoric and all the arguments and all the catfighting that'll go on here in the next through the media. No offense intended to our friends in the Fourth Estate. They're the ones that make the money on this deal. And about $1 billion will be spent by each campaign. $1 billion by each campaign, mostly on media. Trump will probably only use Twitter and cable. There, that's where his votes are, and that's the people he wants to talk to. That's where the independent is. So it'll be interesting to watch. And he generally likes cable because it picks up that 6 o'clock in the evening to 10 o'clock cycle, whereas regular commercial, the other stations are just reporting news, and by the time you get home at 6 o'clock or listen to 10 o'clock news, you've already heard it. Why have you already heard it? Because you already probably read about it on your handheld or picked it up somewhere else, even maybe on the radio driving to and from somewhere. So not much old news gets reported on cable. It's kind of all new. And so it would be interesting to see how the time buys come down for each candidate. There won't be much print or direct mail. It's too expensive. It costs a dollar to mail one envelope. Even with the special rates that people that are on public ballots get, it's just very expensive. So it's generally going to be electronic, at least in the Republican side. I don't know anything about the other campaign. So I think that's about it. I think there'll be a lot of questions, and I'd rather stop right here because I could talk more about the convention itself, the Rules Committee, the Platform Committee. I forgot to mention that. Big debate in our party, and the Republican Party, is going to happen over the public policy of our country. And you can see in that book is basically devoted to the planks. You've heard that word used, the positions that are articulated by the convention, and they will vote on a policy report that will come to them. And decide on health care and taxes and tax reform and all those things. Both parties will have this document, which you have in front of you, which will articulate their views. And you would think bind their candidate. I don't think either one of these two nominees will particularly be interested in being bound by their party's platform, but we'll see. People say platforms and all that time spent preparing them is a waste of time. People don't pay attention to them. But really, quite honestly, they do. One last comment. Please believe in the political party process, the two-party process system. It wasn't called Republican and Democrat in the original sense. It was the Whigs, the Tories, the Populists, the Federalists. Those were the names of the parties then. But if you go back and look at the Constitution, our organizing document, the Charter, into it we built two distinct ways of governing and tried to resolve the conflicts. We said in the Charter those things enumerated, right, will be ceded by the 13 colonies then parochially gathered on the eastern seaboard to create this central government, a confederation of states, these certain specific powers that would be common to all. And those things not enumerated shall be reserved to the states or to the people by the 9th and 10th Amendments, the Bill of Rights, which gives guidance to how we look at whether it's clean air and clean water, which doesn't stop and start with a state boundary, or it's a school and educational system, which principally is local and left to the states, not enumerated. So that two-party system is important. It's served us well. And you can simply stand it up this way, compare it to Italy with 60-some governments in 60-some years. When there's when the prime minister sneezes, there's a vote of confidence. And a new government is formed. And the same is true of most countries. They have splinter parties, multiple parties. So like it or not, when a professor at a university, normally quite liberal, says there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties. They're both alike. They're all alike. My father used to say they're no damn good. The fact of the matter is they stand for something. And I was struck when I was giving a tour of about 60 elderly Japanese men, when I was privileged to be your member in Congress, and I'd been waxing eloquent and saying, this is the Library of Congress, and this is the Supreme Court building, and this is the Capitol building, and this older gentleman takes his cane and he taps me on the back and he said, Congressman, you really aren't talking about the right things. He said, we have buildings like this, and they're 4,000 years old in our country. He said, you should be talking about the one great thing about America, and that is that you've got the longest continuous form of government in recorded history, the stability of the longest continuous form of government in recorded history. And it struck me that, boy, if every high school kid could come out understanding, pick a party. I don't care which party. Well, yeah, I do. But pick a party. You know, don't be an independent. In fact, it's actually you give up your right to choose the better person in a party in Nebraska because we don't define a registered independent as a party or belonging to a party. So you give up that chance to participate in the system to a large extent, at least in Nebraska, not in all states. So but the party processes are important. I invite you to watch them both. I think you'll learn a lot. And anybody here been a delegate to conventions before? Ed, have you? You have been. John, you have been. Anybody? Bob? Ben? It's a great experience and really fun and exhausting. I mean, you really do work. You don't just sit around and twiddle your thumbs or go to parties. I mean, it's a lot going on. It's a good experience in both parties. Let's go ahead and take some questions.
Well, there's continuing speculation that somehow a different Republican presidential nominee can emerge at the Republican convention. Do you see this as a possibility, and why or why not?
I learned a long time ago to always say yes when someone uses the word possibility, because of course there's a possibility, but highly unlikely, in my opinion, highly unlikely. Remember, in at least the Republican Party, the states chose the delegates most of them based on the popular vote in the primary. The Republican Party had 17 candidates. Actually, there were 21, if you go really back and look at who was going to run to start. Mary and I counted them up. There were more than 17, but you hear the 17 that kind of stood on the platforms in the debates, first tier, second tier. I think that's pretty healthy. I mean, I don't know why the lamentation about this. Donald Trump fought his way through a whole bevy of very talented, very in their own right, very capable and well-reported individuals. And it had a healthy discussion, and sometimes the rhetoric was shrill and maybe uncomfortable. Nothing's the same in this world today as it was 4 years ago. We're facing a lot of – you have an unconventional candidate in Donald Trump, fought his way through 17 of those people through a year and a half of activity. You have a disruptor in Bernie Sanders, right? Look what he did. Look what he accomplished against no one gave him a prayer of doing as well as he did. Because there's a lot of dissatisfaction in this country, and it's not just Republican or Democrat or independent. It's just that people have a malaise. I wonder if that word comes back. We'll wait and see if it comes back. So I think that there are some mugwumps. That's another political descriptive word that came out of nowhere. With all due respect to Senator Sass, to former Governor Kaur, to Mitt Romney, former governor and candidate Mitt Romney, with all due respect, they benefited from the system. They got to where they were politically because they supported it and participated in the system. So to teach a kid in high school that I don't like either one and I'm not going to vote or mark my presidential ballot is a real cop-out, and it really sends a very negative message regardless of your political choice.
Well, with that being said, do you envision a major split within the Republican Party over Donald Trump's candidacy?
I was a state chairman for Jeb Bush and for a long time was looking for a candidate after he pulled out. I would have had a whole lot more trouble with a Ted Cruz if he were the nominee of the party, even though I think that's an individual who accomplished a lot, and the senator was certainly popular in Nebraska. But I am not, personally, a hardcore, locked-to-the-right, Tea Party-type philosophical Republican. I'm a moderate to middle-of-the-road, center-right Republican. And so that would have been hard for me. On the other hand, I would support the party's nominee. I think the principles of the party that nominee, including Senator Cruz, would have carried would be on the issues where I would generally normally be. I may not like the extreme definition of the way he would look at it, but I only pick on Senator Cruz to be respectful in that he's very well defined intellectually. Very sharp mind. He understood the issues well, presented himself well. So very respectable, but just that philosophically that's where I would not be. And it would have been harder for me actually to support him than to support Donald Trump because I know where Donald Trump stands on most of the issues. If you can get past the rhetoric,
got to do this just a little bit.
But haven't we all had that? For those of you listening on the radio, I was kind of holding my nose. But isn't it true? Haven't you come across some experience in your life where you've had to hold your nose a little bit and kind of take a deep breath or might step back a little bit and wasn't quite as comfortable as I'd like to be in some place or with someone? But, you know, you kind of figured comparatively, this is a comparative choice. Remember the nose, the ears and the eyes, and just go to sleep in this thing for a while. And if you peel back the onions and you look at both these candidates, they're pretty well defined. They're very different, and they're actually pretty clear on the issues. And comparatively, there's quite a contrast between the two. So generally, I use my hands, for those of you listening on the radio, and I use my left hand and say, do you want to go more left or do you want to go more right? And I use my right hand. It's a pretty simple choice in many ways. The media will try to do their best to make it one catfight. But if you peel back on the principles, on the policies, the way we want America to be, it's a pretty clear choice, I think.
Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have high negatives in national polls. How do you see the negative factors playing out as we approach the general election?
On that one, it's a draw.
This is from the audience. Thank you for noting the uniqueness of Nebraska's proportional electoral vote system. Do you think we should retain the system in Nebraska or revert to winner-take-all as Governor Ricketts wants?
I have such a great reverence for, as you heard me say before, the two-party system and the fact that we do have our vigorous debates on the issues, but we end up making a decision, right? We're going to yes or no it. There's going to be a majority and a minority. We're going to make public policy. I always remember what Ronald Reagan said, and I was in the room when he said it. It's been written about in two books. In fact, I was sitting right next to him. In fact, it was the first time I was in the White House on my day after being sworn in, and I was sitting right next to him at breakfast, and I got his autograph. I was so excited. It was just so much fun. And he stood at a podium like this with a set of 3x5 cards. He spoke off of 3x5 cards. And he said, "Let me tell you what I think of people like you." We're all kind of, you know, opening our eyes at that point. There were 54 new, brand new, first week Republican House members in a class of 80 that came in, 54 were Republican. And he said, "I've never been a lawmaker. I've never been a legislator, but I had to deal with them when I was governor of California. I had to deal with lawmakers in our assembly there." And he said, "I want you to stand for your principles and I'll stand for mine." And then he did that famous B actor, little grin and winked, and tilted his head a little bit to the right. I never saw him tilt his head to the left, always to the right. And he said, and then he used his hand, used his finger, and he pointed in a circular fashion to his feet, and he said, "Once in a while you'll see the concrete cracking around my feet." And he said, "By that I mean, there'll be times when we disagree. And our goal should be to find compromise, and when we do, fall forward. Never compromise unless we fall forward." And that's always instructive to me, that's what really politics is all about. And I wish it were less rancorous, sure. I wish it was less narrow sometimes. I wish it was more polite and respectful in a way. But then I went back and listened to the tapes from Ronald Reagan's first election. He was called a Nazi, a narcissist, that the atomic bombs were going to go off all over the world if he was elected. The same rhetoric, ladies and gentlemen. It hasn't changed. I don't know why, except, again, if it's this little thing we all carry around now that's got us instantly knowing that the alligator, you know, got that little kid, you know, from Alcorn we've all been so sad about, or what happened in that nightclub. And we know about some small thing that happened somewhere in the world, communicated instantly to us, which tends to emotionalize us more than I think in the past, that we have maybe more media than we deserve as we try to struggle to keep our republic. So I'm very much opposed to the way in which we split our vote in Nebraska. If you thought I forgot the question. The two-party system, I want to maintain it. We should be winner-take-all. That is the appropriate way for a small state like Nebraska's voice to be heard. If you did it the other way around, ladies and gentlemen, the Electoral College wouldn't count, because 11 states, again, would control all the votes in the Congress, the House, and the Senate. Nebraska wouldn't count. Just throwing away your strength. You're throwing away your power. Whether it's Democrat or Republican, doesn't make any difference. When you dilute your system that way, even though it might seem so egalitarian, you end up losing the strength that you need to have a strong two-party system.
Some Republicans worry that a Trump candidacy could lead to the loss of the Republican majority in the Senate and maybe even in the House. Do you have any of those fears?
No, I don't, as a matter of fact, and I may be an outlier on this. I have no concern about the House majority being well maintained. The Senate was in play, and we'd hear that same kind of fear message from those who wish it were the other way for a variety of reasons. One is that two-thirds of the people up in the Senate races are Republican, and only one-third that are up and the third that are up are Democrat. So just on the numbers, the odds would be that the Republicans would lose seats in this election regardless of who our nominee was. So that was just going to be. Does Trump make that any more worse, if you will? Does it make it any more likely that we lose? I don't think so. I think North Carolina is always going to be hard. I think that Kelly Ayotte in the Northeast is always going to be difficult as a Republican in her state. I think that Wisconsin and Minnesota, or Wisconsin is a tough state. Illinois is a tough state, as they say, blue versus red. But on the other hand, there's potential pickups in Colorado and in New Hampshire, in Nevada. So you end up, my prediction is that the Republicans will lose 2 seats. At worst, we'll end up with 52. We'll lose seats, but we still should keep the majority in the Senate, after all is said and done.
Do you see Republican candidates distancing themselves from Trump here in the 2nd Congressional District? Have you talked to Republican Don Bacon about whether he will be supporting Trump as Bacon tries to unseat Democrat Brad Ashford, and how would you advise him?
Well, since I'm Don Bacon's finance chairman, I want to warn you that my answer follows my bias. And I'm comfortable that General Bacon is going to vote for Donald Trump. And in fact, I've seen benchmark polling in the last 2 weeks here in the 2nd District that shows Donald Trump very strong and winning in the 2nd District. I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that he'll carry the 2nd District and get the electoral vote. So it affects the 2nd District House race, and it brings out the Trump voter for Bacon, which in turn helps both of them, I saw, and it helps in voter turnout here, too. You have some other sub-issues here. You have the XL pipeline. It may be curious for you to remember what's going to be on the ballot. You have the death penalty issue on the ballot. So that makes it tough for Ashford. You have the gambling issue. You have the constitutional amendment and two, by initiative, legislative expanded gambling referendums on the ballot. So the mix of the voter turnout here is probably more governed by those issues than by Donald Trump.
I think these questions kind of go together. One is, did Ralph Nader affect the presidential election in 2000? Which party lost votes? And then this other question is, without doubt, Trump's campaign has brought tens of thousands of people into the Republican Party, but will they stay if he loses the election?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I'd speculate on the last question that I think just what's going on in the world has got people more interested in this election. And I really do give Donald Trump credit for not necessarily bringing hundreds of thousands of people into the Republican Party. I discount that a little bit because I think there's just a lot of people interested in what's going on. And they tend to be more conservative, and they tend to be independents. And in a lot of states, you can be an independent, and you can pick your ballot. So you can, if you're an independent, you can vote in the Republican primary or you can vote in the Democrat. You can ask them for the ballot. So they may be a Democrat, but they voted in the Republican primary. Now the question is, will they stay in the general election when they can vote for either one? So I'd say on balance, I think that Mrs. Clinton stimulates interest, but I think her problem is Bernie Sanders. And that's where the question might be more germane. Do the Bernie Sanders voters that came out stick with the party and stick with that participatory commitment that they made? Or was that an emotional excitement of a millennial looking up at the faded poster? You know, you've heard that one. Or really being upset because they're no longer on their father's insurance policy because they turned age 27. So Nader, yes, and I was looking for it. I have the number. I can tell you that question. Bush-Cheney versus Kerry Edwards. Nader was on the ballot. That's 2004, New York City, for the Republican Party. 50.7 to 48.2. So George W. Bush-Cheney got a little over 50%, a tad bit over 50% of the popular vote, which is 122 million, by the way. It's one of the bigger turnouts in all of our presidential history. Now, we have more people, too. There's another factor about these turnouts going up is we have more people, so therefore there's more people registered. Basically, it works out this way. Of all people eligible to vote, eligible to register to vote, less than half of those eligible to register, register to vote, and less than half of those who register to vote, vote. So in aggregate terms, even though these numbers have gone up, the other downside of that is, as our population grows and the turnouts don't change, it means that fewer and fewer people are really participating globally in the system, right? That we're electing everybody with 25% of the people in this country that care. So that's an interesting problem that we've got, and I think both Trump and Clinton bring out more voters. I would expect us to break the turnout record in this election. My prediction would be a higher voter turnout on Election Day because of the controversial nature of the campaigns. But I think underneath all that, it's been stimulated by the concerns that so many have about so many different issues. And we're better educated now. Maybe that's the upside of so much media, right? We're just getting inundated, but maybe we're just getting better educated, too, and we're more interested as a result.
Well, I just heard on the news yesterday that there's a chance, a possibility, that maybe another candidate would emerge after the Republican convention. Perhaps another conservative candidate would come out of this convention.
I just can't believe everything you hear on the radio. People that have been in my business for a while get to be pretty cynical about the media, and we don't mean to be, but I think that from time to time we're given good reason to be. It's like all the polls right now, right? Oh, his polls are out. Ronald Reagan was down 24 points on Labor Day. Polls right now don't mean anything, don't tell you anything. I don't even think they read the negatives right, which is the big thing about how high both the nominees' negatives are. I don't think that's being read right. It'll all sort itself out a little more. They'll get more likable as we settle in and have a better understanding of what each one of them would do, or we would trust they would do should they win the election. So I don't think there will be. We have a third party libertarian nominee now, right? I mean, there is this Johnson again, and Weld, his running mate, is former governor of Massachusetts, Weld. Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch both those guys, especially since the guy that stripped on stage at their convention.
Well, there's many hard.
Oh, so, prove you're a libertarian, I guess.
Well, now there are many hardline Republican conservatives, and they've denounced Trump as not really conservative. How do you see him with regard to his conservatism or lack thereof?
Again, I characterize my own view as being more moderate, so I have some discomfort with some of the things that he has said, just as I have a substantial amount of discomfort with what she says and how she says it. And so it's kind of the hold the nose thing. I'm trying to train myself to avoid getting into that trap.
Well, you know, Trump was laughed.
That's the message. Okay. To those people that are so pure that, you know, they can't understand it. You're not going to agree with every candidate on every issue. You just won't. And if you set yourself up in that kind of a rigid framework, there's so many issues that affect all of us. We just got to kind of weigh, right, kind of how it affects you. But it can't be – I hate litmus test voters. I hate people that have single-issue votes, and they just won't budge. They're giving up their right to participate in progress.
Well, early on, Trump's was kind of laughed off by just about everybody as an impossibility. And you've been kind of talking about plugging your nose and everything. Were you one of those? And how do you explain his popularity now among so many people?
Just as moderate Democrats in labor unions will support the Democrat Party nominee, even though they don't like her.
We may need some more questions up here, but isn't there anybody in the Trump campaign that can give Trump some advice about his tweets? It's his tweets that have gotten him into more controversy than just about anything.
By the way, in terms of that last answer, you didn't think I could be brief, did you? But boy, have I learned a lot since I was in public office. So, believing the report I read in the newspaper a day or two ago, or maybe it was on a blog. Remember I said his campaign will be conducted by tweets and by cable? His tweet list is enormous, enough to win the election, and 90% of them are sticking with him. They did a survey of the tweeters and the recipients of his tweets. It's a huge file. It's the biggest assembled file of electronic communication ever in history, far bigger than Mrs. Clinton's. And he communicates with them. So, I mean, you know,
Gee whiz, get over it, you know?
Okay, now's not the time to be brief. Do you take Trump at his word that he has become so conservative on topics such as choice, gun control, immigration, and other social issues?
Let me have a show of hands. Remember now, plug your ears, close your eyes, your nose. Show of hands. Do you think we have a border problem in this country? Most every hand's up in the air. So therefore, the views of the two candidates may differ, but the fact is we're going to have a debate the next 5 months about what should be done about the border, since nothing has been done about it by either party during the last 20 years. So it's okay for me. Now, I had to close my ears to some of the rhetoric, and I called the chief policy advisor for Donald Trump's campaign on the phone, a lawyer from South Dakota. And, in fact, there was a story on him in the World Herald here about a week or 10 days ago, and his picture was in the paper. And I said, here's the way I would do it. I'm going to use one issue. I'm going to use the build the wall thing, okay, the build the wall thing. We're going to build a wall. He's communicating in a very straightforward way about that issue. The wall simply translates simply in a tweet or in the issue to border security. That's what it says to most people. It doesn't mean that the wall will be 10 feet tall or 20 feet tall or 50 feet tall. It won't make any difference if the laws we have are the laws we've got today. It won't make any difference how high the wall is, because less than half the people that come here illegally don't come across the Mexican border. They are a blonde, blue-eyed. Half of Dublin, Ireland, is in Boston. They come from the Canadian border. They come in. They're on visas. They're on visitors' visas. They're on work permits. They overstay those legal entrant documents, and they melt into the framework, and you can't find them. And there's no slope of eye, slant of cheekbone, sound of voice that would cause anyone to detect their presence and question whether or not they were legitimate or legal. So, what he's saying is, in the war on terror and Islamic radicalism, all of these things are simple ways. Now, he's not trying to be simplistic, in my opinion. He's trying to communicate the urgency of an issue that has to be addressed. So I take it that way, because I'm a policy wonk. I think it's important that you don't just fluff off somebody because you didn't like the way they talked about it. You got to think about what they're trying to say. So I said to the policy guy, why doesn't he say at the convention something like this? And I guess you'll all be listening to see if he does this. My recommendation was, and I want the American public to know a little bit more about my thinking about what I mean by building a wall. By what I mean by that is that we police the Mexican border on our side. They don't police their border on their side. So on my first day in office, before I build the wall, which I intend to build if I have to, I'm going to ask the Mexican government to deliver me in 100 days a plan for them to take responsibility for their side of the border and put up their fences or their checkpoints or their people. That's the way to do the wall. So if he just explains himself, see, I think it's the same comment that he made about the judge. If you read about the judge, if he'd have used all the other reasons other than his ethnicity, there wouldn't have been a big brouhaha. Because you can see why he said what he said about that judge. His law firm, their support of Clinton, La Raza, a whole bunch of other things he's done in his life on the liberal left side. He didn't like the judge, right? A lot of people don't like judges. The fact of the matter is he just described it. He didn't explain it. He made a mistake. He made a mistake. And he knows it, too. So I think that's sometimes you got to step in it once or twice and get whacked and you learn your lesson. He's never been in this business before. And one of the refreshing things to me about Donald Trump is he's just straightforward. He's just no window dressing. He's who you see is what you get, you know, and there's no pretense and not parsing everything to be politically correct. And, you know, most Americans are that way. So that's why I think his appeal is there for people of all races, of all walks of life, of all levels of income. He's my blue collar millionaire. I mean, he's just kind of got that lack of pretense about him. He just says, I know who I am. I'm who I am. I'm going to be who I am. And it may not get him to the White House, but, you know, a lot of people would say that that's kind of refreshing in politics today to have somebody, whether we agree with them or not, speak their mind. So.
Well, I know, are you nervous at all about protests or anything at the convention? I know there's been talk that there'll be pretty a lot of disruption.
Mary and I talked about that. Actually, before we decided that I might seek an opportunity to be elected to serve as a delegate again this time. I'm going as a delegate from Nebraska to the Republican National Convention to make sure the police in Cleveland do their job. That's a joke. Yeah, it's a joke. Just kidding. Just kidding. There are always protests at every convention, both parties. The prayer I have is that they be respectable and respectful and without eggs and glass and bottles and that kind of stuff. And there's always designated by permit only protest areas. And if it's all organized right, I think it'll be fine at both conventions. It may be loud, and the media may be there with a camera up in somebody's face that's screaming something or waving something, but you know, and try to make a big deal out of it. But I expect it to be. Cleveland seems to have everything well planned, and I'm very pleased about the fact that the environment will be safe.
This will be our last question. Nebraska state law and most states' laws bind their delegates. If the Rules Committee unbinds delegates, which prevails, state law or Rules Committee?
I don't want anybody to have me on record on that since I'm sitting on the Credentials Committee, and that could be bearing on decisions I'd have to make on Friday and Saturday before the convention. Generally speaking, I think that if that occurred, probably 40 states' delegates would be very upset because 40 of the states, the delegates matched to Trump enough that I don't see what good would come from the unbinding change in the rule for binding. The rule would have to be there are no commitments don't have to be honored. It's kind of an honor system in a lot of ways. There'll be votes cast on the floor in this convention for a number of the 17 who are on ballots around the country. There'll be votes cast on the floor in the roll calls for Rubio and for Cruz and others who earned through the process the right to have those votes cast in the first and second ballot. And so you'll see a variety of other candidates get votes. I wouldn't support it, and I don't think it'll happen.
All right. Well, thank you. Our next Noon Forum is July 21st, and our speaker will be Leo Adam Biga. He'll discuss boxer Bud Crawford's humanitarian visit to Africa. Our thanks to our audience here at the Press Club and our KIOS listening audience, and a special thanks to Hal Dobb. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard A Glimpse of Cleveland, A Crystal Ball for the Republican National Convention. The speaker has been Hal Dobb, former congressman from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, former mayor of the city of Omaha, and currently a member of the University of Nebraska Board of Regents. Mr. Dobb has attended 10 Republican National Conventions. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 16, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.